Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. And heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Governor Gary Herbert signs a bill lowering the legal blood alcohol limit to 0.05. Senator Orrin Hatch expresses support for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. The Salt Lake City School District commits to protecting the privacy of its undocumented students. And a Utahn is among those killed and his wife among those injured in a terror attack in London. Joining me in the studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Thank you.
Education, health, and environment reporter Benjamin Wood. I'm not certain about your title there. Hopefully I got it right.
Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Paul Raleigh, Salt Lake Tribune columnist. Welcome back. It's been a little while.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is joining us via the phone. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning.
And listeners, as always, you can join the conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up by posting your questions and comments at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. 801-355-TALK. Matt Canham, as I said in the intro, the governor now has signed a bill. I think he signed a bill now that has kind of caused an uproar in some quarters. Last night, he put his signature on this bill that would give Utah the strictest drunk driving blood alcohol limit in the nation.
Right. No, right now, it's 0.08 is your blood alcohol limit to be drunk driving, get a DUI. This bill signed will drop that to 0.05, which will be the lowest in the nation. It is a limit that other countries have with other rules, but we're the first to do this. And the governor signed it, but said there's some caveats. He wants to add some of those additional rules that might be in other countries. And so he's calling for a special session later this summer to actually tweak this law. Now, just because he signed the bill does not mean it goes into effect immediately.
Right.
If nothing else changes, this lower blood alcohol limit will go into effect December 30th of 2018. So we have a little bit of time to play with here. But what this means is for the average woman, you can have about two drinks before you would hit the blood alcohol limit. For the average man, about three drinks in an hour and a half period of time. But that also depends a lot on the individual, their body weight, their metabolism. So there's a lot of things that could factor into that. Essentially, the point is from the state lawmakers is they do not want you to drink and drive at all.
Whatsoever. So Governor Herbert had been getting a number of calls, I think, from, well, both supporters, but also those who really wanted to see him veto this bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a lot of restaurant associations and obviously people who make alcoholic drinks weren't a big fan of this one. They're concerned that this will have an economic hit. There's also people who are worried that it could hurt tourism because this is a bill that will make Utah unique and it might be confusing for people who come from other parts of the country to know what this actually means when they want to go out to a restaurant and have a glass of wine. So there's some concern in that area. There's also people who think it isn't really doesn't really work in the sense that if you're a police officer and you pull someone over, how do you know they're 0.05? If we've all kind of determined that 0.08 is where you can determine impairment, when someone's at 0.05, what do you do? And Robert Gerke, our columnist, did his own experiment in this area where he had a retired police chief come in and give him and five others field sobriety tests and breathalyzer tests as they drank over a course of a couple hours. And this was where they followed all the rules that the cops would follow. And what was interesting in that one is Robert Gerke failed the field sobriety test, but was only at 0.04. And then passed the field sobriety test when he was 0.11. I don't know what that says about Robert Gerke, but what it does show is that it can be a little subjective out there for police officers.
And that process. A question that I have about this is if you are affected, for some people, maybe you're someone of a lower weight and you don't have food in your system, and so one drink might get you over that 0.05 limit in some instances. And if you're breaking the law after one drink, isn't this essentially the same as a total prohibition on driving with any alcohol whatsoever in your system?
That's kind of what they want. And the National Transportation Safety Board in D.C. that oversees these big accidents that happen on our roadways or our railways is a big proponent of this law. They think this is a safety measure that will help. And so for them, that is the goal. They do not want you to have any alcohol and drive. They want to send the message that if you go out, have a few, find an alternative way to get home.
You know, if you are driving and you get pulled over for something like a broken taillight, and then an officer says, have you been drinking this evening? You know, a common response is, well, I had one glass of wine at dinner, or I had a beer. Is that now grounds for them to administer a breathalyzer? Do they have to go through? What are the steps that an officer has to go through?
This is a lot of discretion that the police officers have to determine if someone should do a field sobriety test, and at which point they can do a breathalyzer and even a blood test if they feel necessary. And if you don't, if you deny it, if you say, I don't want to do that, you lose your license for a certain period of time. Utah's DUI laws are very strict. And one of the things that Governor Herbert wants to see in the special session, or at least talk about, is maybe having lower penalties if you get caught at a blood alcohol level between 0.05 and 0.08, and then ratchet up the penalties as it goes up. That's something talked about very briefly yesterday, so we don't know the details of what that would actually look like. But my understanding is there are plenty of foreign countries where that is the case.
Okay. I'd like to bring in Salt Lake Tribune opinion columnist Paul Raleigh. We've seen some full-page ads by the American Beverage Institute on this. They want to see this undone. There are fears about the effect on tourism. Proponents of this measure and that the governor says he's going to sign, though they plan on tweaking it, say this is about protecting people and about enacting, you know, kind of changing the culture here. What's your take on this?
Well, there are a lot of different aspects that weren't considered. I had a column earlier in the week about how this might affect priests during Mass or the Holy Liturgy of the Greek Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, because they are required when they administer Holy Communion. And the parishioners, have their sip of wine, which is consecrated and is considered the blood of Christ. They are required to drink what is left over in the chalice after all the parishioners have gone through it.
Required by their faith. Yeah.
Required by their faith because it is the blood of Christ, and so they can't pour it down the drain. Mm-hmm. And then they also, the Greek Orthodox priests, they have to fast from the night before because they don't want to mix the what is considered the body and blood of Christ with secular food. Mm. And so they're doing this on an empty stomach. The Catholics change that. They only have to fast now an hour before. But oftentimes it's the equivalent of a glass and a half or two glasses of wine that they have to consume. Oftentimes, After their Mass or liturgy, they are summoned to the hospital to administer to sick or dying parishioners. So they have to get in their car and drive. So one priest I talked to said he's never felt impaired after this, but he worries that this could put him at the 0.05.
Well, is this so, Matt Canham? I'm going to go back to you. You know, we're talking about tweaks to the law. I imagine nobody's talking yet about exemptions for clergy in this. But you know, what kind of tweaks are we looking at, and what are they going to try and enact in the special session that they're doing? You mentioned some of it already.
Yeah, I mentioned one. The other options are a few. I mean, I think there's certain requirements that go along with blood alcohol level that go beyond driving. So you have gun rights activists in Utah who are worried that you at 0.08 are not allowed to carry a firearm when you're in transportation. Mm-hmm. So if it drops to 0.05, if you go out and have a glass of wine at dinner and decide to carry a concealed weapon, you could actually be violating the law there too. Mm-hmm. So they want to carve out for that, which was something I actually didn't know about until I read the Salt Lake Tribune this morning. That's why you read the paper. So there's a few options there that they're going to look at. What the governor wants is to hold a series of public hearings to really explore what this means. And restaurants are hoping that if you get caught with a blood alcohol level lower than 0.08, but between higher than 0.05, that it would be more like an infraction than the full lose your license, pay $10,000, go to jail, fine, you know, and all the other things that happen when you actually get a full-fledged DUI.
There's got to be a watering down pun to make here about that
effort.
Yes,
exactly.
Paul Raleigh, you had a point to make there.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up one little, what I consider an irony, the same session where they passed the 0.05 limit for safety reasons, they also passed a bill doing away with safety inspections, which was vigorously imposed by that one highway patrol trooper in the legislature, because he talked a lot about how mechanical problems often cause fatal accidents. And so I just found that to be a little bit of an ironic twist.
To the legislative session. I'm going to remind our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation. Call us at 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. I'm thinking about this. This is about trying to change the culture of people getting behind the wheels after having any drinks whatsoever. Something that might make that an easier thing to swallow or to sip, I guess, would be rezoning to allow something like a neighborhood pub where you could, pop down to the pub for a pint and then walk back home. I don't know how much. Maybe that's happening a little bit more now in Salt Lake City.
It's happening
in particular.
More in Salt Lake City, but when you look at Utah as a whole, that's probably not going to happen in the majority of our state, which is pretty conservative and probably doesn't have the drinking populace in some areas to support such a thing. It's interesting. This is a bill that's getting a lot of attention and will, from what the governor said, for months to come. And it came right when the Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics rolled out our new poll and showed the split here. So it showed that 50% of our respondents who are registered voters supported this new law. 47% were against it. But there was a massive religious split. Very active Mormons favored the law 67% to 30. Every other religious group, and that includes people who are somewhat active Mormons, were against this bill 2-1 the other way. So there is a huge religious split here.
And some of that, I'm sure people who are worried about the perception from the outside of what Utah looks like. So this is an attempt by lawmakers to change the culture of people who consume alcohol in the state. But again, Matt, as you're kind of pointing out here, for the most part, lawmakers don't fall into that group of people who are consumers of alcohol.
90% of Utah's lawmakers are Mormon. So we would assume that the overwhelming majority of those people do not drink alcohol.
And Paul Raleigh, go ahead.
I was going to say, when I spoke to the sponsor of the 0.05 bill about how this might affect the priests in the Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox, he'd never considered that. I mean, it was something, say that, like what Matt says, 90% are Mormons. They don't have there's a bit of myopia there. I mean, they just don't consider how this affects other, cultures and that sort of thing.
So Utah leading out on this. Matt Canham, when does this take effect again?
It is it takes effect in December, the end of December in 2018, if nothing else changes. But the governor's already saying we're going to have another debate on this and we might have some tweaks to this law. But he thinks this is a public safety measure and that's why he signed it.
Okay. Well, as fun as this is, we need to turn to other stories from this past week. Before we do, though, let's take a quick break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and on Utah Public Radio. Stick around. We'll be back in about a minute's time. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, Education Reporter Benjamin Wood, and columnist Paul Raleigh. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. Tommy Burr in Washington, D.C., to you there and the news that's coming out of the nation's capital. Let's start with a story that broke early in the week that the FBI was investigating potential Russian hacking of the U.S. election, as well as ties the Trump campaign might have to that effort. This came out in testimony before the House Intelligence Committee. Utah's Representative Chris Stewart is a member of that committee. What kind of a role did he play in this hearing, Tommy?
You know, I think Stewart played the role that a lot of Republicans played during that hearing, which was a very interesting and very long hearing with the FBI director and the head of the NSA, both testifying about the investigations and what they found out about Russia's meddling in the election last year and the possibility of ties between the Trump campaign and Trump team with the Russian officials. Stewart, like all most Republicans, were trying to get to the point of either blaming the leakers for damaging, you know, classified information, leaking that information, and also pressing the FBI director, James Comey, on whether there was any wrongdoing. And in the exchange with Stewart and Comey was essentially, okay, you might be investigating, but that doesn't mean anyone did anything wrong.
Right.
And the FBI director says, you know, certainly not. It's one of those, even if somebody technically charges a crime, you know, they're innocent until proven guilty, which was one of the things the Republicans really wanted out of that hearing. But it was pretty damaging news, and we've seen this news since that, including just half an hour ago with the House Intelligence Chairman talking about there was no wiretapping of Trump Tower, as the president had claimed in several tweets earlier this month.
Right.
And it's just an ongoing story.
Okay. You know, he also that's an interesting point that half an hour ago he says that there's no evidence whatsoever, just that there was no wiretapping of Trump Tower. That's something that the president claims, and it's something that he hasn't yet retracted. I'm assuming that's still the case, Tommy?
Yeah, and I'm not sure he will retract. In fact, the White House has tried to clarify since that when he said wiretapping, he was talking about general surveillance, and that could be, you know, anything from intercepted phone calls between somebody on the Trump team and a Russian official or other foreign sources where the actual surveillance was on the subject of the call outside the United States and not necessarily inside Trump Tower. The chairman of the Intel Committee was very clear today, also saying that whatever wiretapping, whatever surveillance was done legally. So that also undercuts the president's point that it was Barack Obama who illegally and some kind of scandal was tapping into his campaign.
You know, getting back to that House Intelligence Committee meeting, there's not a lot that we learned from, you know, what was going on with this investigation into ties with Russia or Russian election hacking, meddling, whatever you want to call it. We didn't learn much more than the fact that those investigations were happening, right?
Yeah, essentially. But I mean, that's a big deal. The FBI does not normally come out and say we're investigating something. They usually want to investigate it and decide whether to press charges before they move forward on anything and say anything publicly. So that's a pretty big disclosure from the FBI to say that they're actually looking into this. It looks like now Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign chairman for a while last year and has his own ties to the Ukraine and Russian officials, is now going to is willingly going to testify before the House Intelligence Committee, which is continuing its probe. Democrats are very clear that they want an independent prosecutor to take a look at that, take it out of the partisanship world and give it to somebody who can, you know, kind of objectively look at what happened.
Is that likely to happen, though, Tommy, given the makeup of Congress?
Given the makeup of Congress and the partisanship here in Washington, I don't know, but it's not likely at the moment. However, as this continues to come down, when you have the House Intelligence Committee chairman going to the White House to brief the president on what he learned about this ongoing investigation into the president and his team, it does underscore the need in some ways for somebody outside of Congress to do this.
Okay. I want to bring in Paul Raleigh, Salt Lake Tribune opinion columnist, here into this conversation. I can't tell, Paul, where we are in this. Accusations of election hacking or election tampering, that's being looked into. Ties to Russia being looked into. Are these scandals in the making? Are they already, you know, full-blown scandals? Are they something else altogether?
Well, I think that there's a lot of smoke there. I mean, I think that there could be some scandals. I mean, there is a lot of at least evidence that would suggest some more probing. As far as the Russians and the Trump campaign and that sort of thing. You know, I just want to say, I think Sean Spicer has the hardest job in America. Yeah. The spokesman for Trump, to get up there and try and make this credible, all these claims and that sort of thing. But the other thing is the partisanship and how I believe that this part is the way in Congress how they determine what they want to investigate and what they don't has become so partisan. It was like Hillary Clinton was like guilty until proven innocent, and Jason Chaffetz wanted to have hearings about on her forever. And now things are coming up in the with the Trump campaign and the Russian connections and everything else, it's like, hey, nothing to see here, folks. You've got John McCain now. He's calling for an independent committee.
Which belies a little bit the idea of, I mean, he's always been called the maverick and kind of the rogue and not necessarily part of the partisan makeup, but there are those examples of people who are outside of the sort of so-called teams side of this, I guess.
Well, that's right, and one of the things was, I mean, there was some concern among Republicans and some of the heavy hitters like McCain and Lindsey Graham and those type of people, when the chairman of the Intel committee, runs over to the Trump campaign to tell him what they've got is, I mean, what happened to the separation of powers and that sort of thing.
You know, there's this. One thing I kind of wonder about is if the Democrats in Congress have been trying pretty hard to paint Trump as almost a Manchurian candidate. If these investigations come up, short of what they're expecting, will they have lost some political capital on this? When maybe there are other things to look at, like tax returns, business conflicts, emoluments clause, which they are looking into. But I feel like there's really full court press on Russia right here, and I don't know who to bring in on that. Tommy Burr, what do you think?
No, sure, I'm happy to talk about that. I think in Washington, it's necessarily the smoke that gets you in trouble and the cover-up that gets you in trouble, not the actual action. With Hillary Clinton, for example, there was really nothing found in the emails necessarily. The FBI cleared Hillary Clinton of any wrongdoing in sharing any classified information over her private email server. But that didn't seem to matter to a lot of people. It was the actions and the rhetoric around that hurt her in the 2016 election. So even if necessarily they don't find the smoking gun or whatever it might be with Russia, it still harms Trump, and Democrats can claim a little victory that there was something going on there in some form. But there are so many different issues that are happening this administration. You mentioned a few, but just, the business ties around the world and whether he's taking any benefit from foreign governments
right.
is one.
Go ahead.
No, I think you're fine there. I think there's many issues that are still continuing. It's not just the Russia thing.
Yeah, well, I want to just give Paul Brawley a last word on that thought before we move into those business conflicts, because I want to get to that story as well.
Well, the other thing that President Trump is so unwilling to let go of this wiretapping thing and all that stuff, and he's tweeting all the time, and he seems and then Spicer gets up and tries to make some sense of what Trump is saying. And the White House seems so obsessed with this. And you got Trump tweeting all the time. I mean, when does he have time to be president of the United States? I mean, he's got a country to run, and he's. I think it's just ridiculous what's going on.
All right. Well, interesting times, Tommy. I want to go back to you on a story that you wrote about some constituents of Congressman Jason Chaffetz who want him to look into some of the things that we were just talking about, in particular the emoluments clause of the U.S. Constitution and whether the president is in violation of it. These aren't just any constituents, though. They are BYU and Utah law professors. Tell us who these legal scholars are and what they are asking Representative Chaffetz to do.
Yeah, sure. We're talking about two actual petitions. One was for like lawyers and law professors. Yeah. Another was for constituents and Utahns and other people, other Americans. So there are about 300 people who signed one petition for the lawyers and law professors, and that includes 20-25 people, law professors at BYU and the University of Utah. And all of them are pretty much saying, okay, look, Congressman Chaffetz, you're on a role here where you have oversight of the executive branch, and you need to fulfill that role. And yes, you may be of the same party, but you know, the founders set up the system of checks and balances, and you need to provide that check. Specifically, they think that Chaffetz should be looking at Trump's business ties and his possible conflicts of interest. You mentioned the emolument clause. The idea that in the Constitution, it is very clear that a president or government official should not be taking any benefit from a foreign power. And that was set there in stone because the idea is we didn't want to have a president who was subject to, you know, Britain or France or some other country at the time trying to buy their favor.
Okay, and as you report, most Utahns are of a mind on this, that by a 2-3 margin, they think this is something that Chaffetz and the House Oversight Committee should be looking at those conflicts, according to a new poll.
Yes, absolutely, and it's just great timing that this poll came out right now. But an even 60% of registered voters say Chaffetz should be probing Trump's potential conflicts. About 32% said he shouldn't. That's probably about the same percentage of people in Utah who like the president and don't want these ongoing investigations. For his part, yeah. Chaffetz says he's already doing several investigations. He said to me yesterday that, in fact, there are more investigations right now ongoing into the Trump administration than there were of Barack Obama at the same time in his first term. And some of those, he says, are not made public. So we don't know necessarily what other stuff is going on, but we do know that there is still a lot of pressure on Chaffetz to do more.
Is he saying, though, that, I mean, there are all of these investigations ongoing, but is he saying that he won't carry out an investigation of the kind that, you know, either of those petitions is asking or wants to see, and that Utahns, according to this poll, are in favor of?
No, in fact, he's saying he will, and he's not afraid to go after the president, but he doesn't want to go on any fishing expedition. He wants to do, you know, specific issues and not just, you know, toss out a whole bunch of subpoenas and see what comes back. In fact, my favorite quote from him yesterday was, "This is now Donald Trump's administration, and there will inevitably be someone doing something stupid somewhere."
Paul Raleigh, opinion columnist, a different side of essentially the same topic we were talking about before. Representative Jason Chaffetz said he was, says that he's going to, before the election, he said he was going to be a kid in a candy store investigating Donald Trump. Should he be going further than he is? Is he doing due diligence here?
Well, I didn't know that he claims now that there are all sorts of investigations going on that aren't made public. I mean, we had a quote in our paper, you know, from Brigham Daniels, one of the professors who's calling on him to do more investigation, and saying that every kid in the candy store he knows would be acting differently and wouldn't be looking at their feet if they were in a candy store,
right,
like Chaffetz seems to be. I believe, and I've said this before, that Chaffetz has acted so partisan and has used his position on the committee in an extremely partisan way. When Benghazi happened and Barack Obama was in the process of running for re-election, they were trying to make it all his fault until he won the election. And then when Hillary Clinton started to look like she was going to be, then it was all her fault. But I remember Chaffetz was pushing hard to get a hearing on Benghazi before the election. That looked pretty partisan to me as well.
Paul Raleigh there. One thing I want to kind of check in on this is how abnormal has the start of this presidency been compared to others? Tommy Burrell, Washington bureau chief, the lack of a tax return, the not really disentangling himself from his business empire or not seeming to, at least, not to mention some controversial policy decisions, not the least of which might be the travel ban that was renewed last week and has since been blocked. Are we in uncharted waters? Is this normal, Thomas Burr?
You know, the president used to get some kind of a honeymoon to start out, and they would, you know, have a few months to kind of get up and running, and there was a little pause that everyone kind of gave them. There hasn't been one in this administration, and that's partially because of some controversial decisions that have been made by the president. Let's add the idea that Ivanka Trump may now get her own, like, West Wing office in some form. And that's just, you know, different than any other president has done in the past. So partially, I think this is the country is more polarized and divided. And it's also just some of these decisions that have been made by this White House are not in the mainstream of what the public supports.
Okay. You know, I want to save some time for the latest confirmation hearings that have been happening there in D.C., and those have to do with Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's pick for Supreme Court for the seat left open since the death of Antonin Scalia in early 2016. Lots of questions in those hearings, but Tommy, maybe we should start with some news that emerged pretty recently. Senate Democrats are planning, I think, to filibuster his nomination, Neil Gorsuch's nomination. Something that's, maybe payback for Republicans not seating President Barack Obama's nominee.
So I think we all expected that at some point the Democrats would force a 60-vote threshold to put Gorsuch over the top here. I think Democrats are definitely still smarting from the idea that President Obama had named Merrick Garland to the court. Republicans refused to even hold a hearing on that nomination for, 9 months or so, until President Trump came into office, and within, 2 months, they're holding a hearing on his nominee. But I think that the filibuster idea is not new. What the scary part is right now here in Washington is the idea that Republicans may change the rules to just have a simple majority approve the Supreme Court nominee, which has not been the case in the Senate for generations.
Okay. So maybe changing the rules there. He's not necessarily a popular pick with Democrats, but this is kind of, because of the fact that they'd rather see Merrick Garland there. Gorsuch has broad support on the Republican side, though, and one Gorsuch champion in particular has kind of emerged, and he's a Utah, and of course, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
Yes, and Senator Hatch has played this role in many a Supreme Court nomination. He's participated in, 14 different nominations in his time in the Senate, and this is typically how it goes. If the White House is of your party and nominating somebody you like, you play defense and a cheerleader situation, asking softball questions, giving them time to clarify anything that they didn't get the chance to say when Democrats were lobbying, some really tough and challenging questions. Senator Hatch is the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee and, a legal scholar in his own mind when it comes to these things, because he's been around for long enough to have, everyone on the Supreme Court right now is a sitting justice, went through a meeting with Senator Hatch and questioning a Senator Hatch.
Did he play that role as well? I mean, asking Gorsuch questions that may have kind of benefited him in these confirmation hearings this week? Or was he asking the softballs you're talking about?
No, sure, exactly. No, I mean, he did. And, he would essentially during the hearings say, okay, well, the Democrats are saying you're a surrogate for President Trump. Are you? And Gorsuch replies, no. And Hatch says, of course not. You know, it was those kind of questionings where he would let him clarify very clearly that he's not in the Trump camp in a nice, easy form.
We mentioned Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick, who waited for months and months after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he wouldn't hold a hearing for him during an election year. This was in 2016. Garland was also someone that Senator Hatch had praised, though he kind of stayed on McConnell's side on that issue.
Yeah, absolutely. No, in fact, I think a week or two before President Obama named Merrick Garland to the court, Orrin Hatch has said he'd be a fine pick and a great pick for the high court. But Senator Hatch was also staying with the Republican talking point that they shouldn't have a confirmation hearing for the Supreme Court, the nation's highest court, during a very polarizing time in the country. I'm not saying that we've changed anything. We're not an election cycle, but I think we're still also very polarized.
Well, I've seen some memes out there saying that there shouldn't be confirmation hearings for Gorsuch because this is Trump's last year in office, wishful thinking on the part of people who want to see the president removed from office. If you're on Team Democrats, you are obstructing. If you're on another team, you're fighting fire with fire by doing the same thing that that had been done before. Paul Raleigh, your opinion on these confirmation hearings?
Well, again, it's Orrin Hatch had a op-ed recently in the Salt Lake Tribune that I actually found jaw-dropping as I was reading it, because he was talking about how the Democrats should not make this political, with the Gorsuch nomination and everything else. And I'm thinking, do you have short-term memory problems? Or because that was what the Merrick Garland thing was all about, it was all politics. And now all of a sudden, the shoe's on the other foot, and the Democrats are making it political, and how dare they? And I mean, it just gets more and more bizarre all the time.
Well, guys, we have to take another quick break, and we'll have to turn to some other stories and move away from Washington. We'll finally bring health, education, and environment reporter Benjamin Wood in on the conversation. Thanks for being patient, Ben. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in a moment.
This is Management Minute by Professor Scott Hammond.
Are you wondering if depth or breadth is best for your career? Are technical skills more important than general management? Well, the answer is yes. 40 years of career research on knowledge workers shows that the vast majority of successful careers begin with solid technical skills. But eventually, if you want to be valued, you will need to let go of what made you successful and go broad. Going broad at the right time after a technical foundation is the formula for most successful careers.
The Management Minute is brought to you by our members and the USU John M. Huntsman School of Business 1-year Master of Business Administration, specializing in strategic business development and value creation, business analytics, and finance. Details at huntsman.usu.edu/MBA.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, Benjamin Wood, and Paul Raleigh. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Ben Wood, so patient.
That's great. I've been learning a lot about the news.
Yeah, you have, as have we all. We were talking about the president's travel ban. Other parts of his immigration policy have been in the spotlight in the wake of federal raids in some immigrant communities to try to address the fear that has sprung up in the wake of some of those actions. The Salt Lake City School District recently adopted a resolution. Tell us about this.
Yes. So the resolution was brought forward by a community advocacy group, Unidad Immigrante, and it essentially asked the school board to affirmatively state that they would protect the privacy of undocumented students. And so after about a month of debate or so, the board did adopt that resolution on I'm losing track of my days. But
sometime this week.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Recently.
Sure.
And yeah, it essentially says that they're not going to cooperate with ICE agents unless they absolutely have to, if they're compelled by law, in very narrow circumstances.
Protecting the privacy of students. Is that something that ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, does all that often, seeking records from public schools?
Well, and that's where it's a little interesting, because locally, no. I mean, it's largely hypothetical at this point. The school district says they have yet to be contacted by ICE agents. They've yet to receive any requests. And yet there are reports from other communities where that has happened. And recently there was a group of federal agents that decided to use an empty school parking lot to gear up. And that was seen by neighbors and residents and kind of stoked some of these fears. And so, yeah, I mean, at this point, that hasn't happened, where agents have come to a school door looking for students. but there is some concern that it could happen. And if it were to happen, what would be the district's response?
Okay, so kind of a preemptive measure. We've also seen that just yesterday, the ACLU of Utah urged law enforcement agencies to be wary of their involvement with ICE, kind of an ongoing part of that story as well. I want to stick on the education beat here. There were some funding cuts at the state level that were threatening a program, and this is kind of a quick turn away from the last story, but a program that was dealing with teacher training. Tell us about the Peer Assistance Review Program and why it's threatened.
Yeah, well, in fact, at this point, the funding has been cut.
Okay.
It's Salt Lake City School District. They've been running it for a few years now, and they had been getting assistance from the state to the tune of $400,000. In the most recent budget, that funding is gone. And what it does is that money allows the district to replace veteran teachers so that those teachers can then work exclusively with their peers. So that money goes to hire a new teacher, freeing up a veteran teacher to travel around the district and coach and mentor and give some feedback and sit in classrooms and watch how novice teachers are doing.
It's a big change from the program that was in place whereby you had more teachers involved in this program, or is it the same number of teachers?
Well, so at this point, the district is looking at funding it themselves. They're hoping to keep it the same size. They've got about 5 mentor teachers working with about 50, a little over 50 novice teachers in the district. The district had been putting in its own $200,000 on top of the $400,000, so now they're looking to scrape $400,000 out of their local money to keep it going.
Okay, so their own local money. Paul Raleigh, this is kind of a program that I think teachers – well, maybe actually, Ben, we'll stick with you for a second. Teachers are there a number of teachers who are upset by the cut to this funding, right?
They are. I mean, the state – you know, we've been hearing a lot about a teacher shortage for several years. We have terrible retention numbers among our teaching profession. And this program has a pretty, you know, statistically significant track record of keeping teachers in the classroom and in the profession year to year. And so for supporters, they say, you know, if this program is working, why would we cut a program that's working when this is a problem statewide?
Paul Raleigh comments on that concept, the idea of a program that's working being defunded.
Well, this has been an ongoing issue in the legislature when it dealing with education for a long time. And there seems to be a growing bias in the legislature toward teachers in general. You know, they want them to be graded. They want them to be tested. There's always rhetoric about, you know, more efforts to get rid of the bad teachers. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there's always been some animosity between the legislature and the Utah Education Association, and they hate unions, and they're always saying that, you know, they say that they're really pro-teacher, but they're, you know, anti-unions, and the unions are destroying everything. And so this is just another example of them not, you know, listening to teacher concerns and that sort of thing. And they, you know, they're more interested in, you know, high-tech, things in the classroom and going out to vendors and private contractors and getting away from the whole public education thing.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join this conversation. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Ben Wood, you mentioned local school districts trying to find money to keep this money going. Does that mean they'll have to sort of reapportion money from one program to another program, or are they seeking outside fundraising efforts, I guess?
So what they're doing is, you know, Salt Lake City School District is, you know, you could call them luckier than other districts in that they have a pretty healthy property tax base, being the capital city. And so they have seen some revenue growth since last year. So they have a few more dollars to work with as they put their budget together. So they think they'll be able to do it with what they have. Long term, though, you know, anything could happen.
Okay. We're going to have to leave that story there just in the interest of time. There's one story I want to get to before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Matt Canham, that is a story of tragedy far away from Utah, but affecting Utah nonetheless. There was a local tie to the attacks that happened in London this week.
Yes, Kurt Cochran died in that attack. He's from West Bountiful, and his wife, Melissa, was seriously injured. They were on their 25th wedding anniversary, and they were walking through London's Westminster Bridge when they were hit by the car driven by the suspected terrorist, believed to be Khalid Massoud, I believe is how you say his name. Kurt was knocked off the bridge where he died, and Melissa was ran into it where she broke a leg, a rib, and had her head cut. Her family has flown to London where she's had surgery, and she's believed to she'll be okay, but it's pretty tragic here. They lived in West Bountiful, as I said. They had a little recording studio in their basement, which was what their business was, and they were beloved in their neighborhood.
Right, and helping musicians record music,
right.
Local musicians.
All over, in all different types. They were really, you know, appeared to be fun-loving, devoted people who were, not only were they on their 25th wedding anniversary, but they were there to visit some parents who were doing a Mormon missionary mission in the area, and they were just about to come home. This happened in the most tourist-heavy spot of London, and it was carried out by a man who believed to be inspired by ISIS, right, to use a vehicle to hit people. And then he had a knife where he killed a police officer before he was shot attempting to get into Parliament. So a pretty horrible situation.
A lot of comments came in from, you know, the president himself tweeted out his sympathy to the family. Senator Orrin Hatch issued a statement. I think all of Utah's congressional delegation said something.
Yeah, you know, we've seen terrorist attacks happen much more in the Middle East or North Africa or even Europe than we have here in the United States, though we've seen our share. It's few times that it's touched this close to home here in Utah, and this is one of them. The President Trump tweeted, "A great American, Kurt Cochran, was killed in the London terror attacks. My prayers and condolences are with his family and friends."
Okay. I know that there's also been a GoFundMe account set up to try and aid the family. And I know that there's a link also at the Salt Lake Tribune's website.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. It's GoFundMe.com / Melissa and Kurt. And Kurt is with a K.
Okay. And finally, this week, I want to turn to one additional story here, Matt, that the Salt Lake Tribune covered. And this has to do with leaks inside of the LDS Church. This is the website MormonTips.com. There are some groups now that are asking for an investigation of the church itself for supposedly procuring favors from foreign governments. This has to do with getting visas for missionaries, I think.
Yes. Really, the cornerstone of this story is Fred Karger and some people who are like him want to go after the LDS Church with everything they have in as many ways as they can. His group is trying to challenge the LDS Church's tax-exempt status. And what they're doing in this case is they're using a video that was leaked last year that included I guess we would use the term an LDS lobbyist, but someone who worked in Washington on behalf of the LDS Church to interact with government officials to try to get visas for missionaries and say that they were doing something untoward. That is a pretty common practice. I covered Congress for 7 years, and it's not unusual for senators to advocate on behalf of people in their state when it comes to travel or immigration status. That's pretty common. But they want to see an investigation to see if there's more than what we saw in that video. And so they're asking the State Department to do so.
And part of the attempt here, I guess their modus is drawing more attention to their website, drawing more leaks out from within the church.
Yes, they are on the full scale attack against the LDS Church with any legal means they can. And, you know, this is their latest attempt to do so. You know, we'll see what happens. I would be surprised if the State Department did a big investigation on this, but you never know.
Okay. Guys, we are now at the point in the show where we need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And I don't know who to begin with. Who's ready with an underplayed story? Thomas Burr in Washington, do you have one?
Sure, I'll jump in. Because we're talking about Trump's potential business conflicts, this week we found out about one that I think is kind of interesting. The Congressman Chaffetz had been questioning the General Services Administration on the lease that the president's company has with the government to rent the old post office tower here in Washington and renovate for the Trump Hotel. The GSA came back and said that the lease is in full compliance. So if there are questions about how are Trump's business dealings working with the U.S. government, this is our first test, and they gave him a big thumbs up.
Okay. All right, that's an interesting underplayed story. Benjamin Wood, education reporter, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, if you're a policy wonk like myself, there's an interesting debate brewing up today about whether or not the state charter school board has eminent domain power. They're going to be meeting today at noon to vote or debate whether they want to join in a lawsuit with a charter school to claim this little patch of private property that would allow buses and cars to go in and drop off students.
Not something that's been done before, I guess?
Yeah, it would be unprecedented. The school itself tried to use eminent domain. A judge decided that they didn't qualify as a board of education because of the characteristics of charter schools. So now they're turning to the state charter school board, and they, too, have never weighed in on a matter like this. So if they choose to, it would be a brand new thing.
And if they choose not to, is that the end of that?
If they choose not to, the school has some decisions to make. They're trying to build a new high school, and one of the options they have is to bulldoze a house and turn it into a driveway and dump traffic into a pretty densely populated neighborhood.
Okay. Check it out at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Paul Raleigh, underplayed story.
I had a column today about a man from Venezuela who was in Sugar House Park with his little dog.
Yeah.
And the dog ran up to a woman to greet the woman. He was a friendly little dog, and she kicked him in the stream and then yelled at the man to go back to Mexico, and we're going to build a wall. And it's just, you know, you hear about these incidents from time to time. And the reason I bring that up in this program is because we also had a story in the paper today about, I believe it was 127 people were made U.S. citizens in a ceremony yesterday. And you just look at those two things together, and you wonder what we're doing and where we're going.
It's a pretty shocking column and a tough read at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, Paul Raleigh's column. Matt Canham, your underplayed story of the week, your pick.
I always like looking at demographics, and the census came out with some new numbers this week that I thought were pretty interesting. The fastest growing county in the United States of America is Little San Juan.
Right.
That to me is stunning. And what's interesting is people down there believe that a lot of it is people going down there to live in that beautiful landscape and are drawn probably in part by Bears Ears National Monument, which has been such a lightning rod issue in this state. And yet it is attracting people to this small county, filling up vacant homes and increasing home prices. They've added, and now this is not going to sound like a massive amount of people for people in the Salt Lake Valley, but they added about 1,200 people in the last year, and that is bigger than their second biggest city. It's a third of the population of their biggest city. So that's a lot of people for that small county.
Fastest growing county in the United States.
That's
a bit good underplayed story of the week from Matt Canham. For my part, I've got to go with The Shot, a 20-year reunion bringing back together the 1997 Utah Jazz who went to the finals after John Stockton sunk the now famous, I mean, all you have to say is The Shot to any jazz fans, and they know exactly what you're talking about. And they brought them back together for a kind of reunion at the Salt Palace. Kidding, at the Energy. What is it? I can't think of the name of it. Vivint Smart Home Arena. Thank you.
Whatever they call it.
Yeah, that place where the Jazz play. And it was kind of a touching, emotional event for anybody who followed that season very closely. Listeners, I know listeners who are jazz fans. I know you know what I'm talking about. Paul Raleigh, Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, Ben Wood, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thank you very much.
I want to quickly mention to listeners that you can find a podcast of the Salt Lake Tribune's fake news forum that they held the other night at the Salt Lake City Public Library. KCPW broadcast that event live. It is up and available at our website, kcpw.org. You can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM and at Twitter. We are at KCPW. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, also to Emily Means at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever service you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us this week, and we will see you on next Friday.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Kane College of the Arts, presenting the Choir of Kings College, featured annually on BBC, a festival of 9 lessons and carols, 8 p.m. Wednesday night, March 29th at St. Thomas Aquinas Catholic Church in Hyde Park. Details at cca.usu.edu.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM Logan. Also heard online at upr.org.